This is John Erickson, and welcome to Advanced Ball Striking, interview with former U.S. amateur champion and PGA Tour winner Sam Randolph. In this installment, we will be discussing what Sam is up to these days, teaching golf. We're going to talk a little bit about the state of the game, and we're going to talk a lot about putting. Sam was one of the best putters that I ever saw during my playing days, and some of his insights into what he did and what he felt on the greens, I think you'll find quite interesting.
Now, moving from player to teacher, you're doing the master's thing, but you got the rest of the year doing a lot of teaching now. How has that been for you to move from player to teacher?
Since I've gone away and been teaching, you know, I've really nailed down the proof of what the heck is true and what's not. And hey, it just comes down to a few things here, you know. Don't interfere with the laws of physics and you're okay.
Sam, do you enjoy teaching and what you're doing now?
Well, I enjoy it. I've always had a knack for being able to help people. And then as my experiences and studying helped me learn more of what's causing what and really going on, there just came a point where I wasn't playing good enough to hang with the top 100 players anymore. I knew I could out-teach the top 100 teachers.
That's a good point.
And so I went more into that. Plus, it was too difficult to even try to play when I was having this trouble with my back. And whether you want to admit it or not, your brain avoids pain, and there's an effect and compensation factors going on when you can't move your body the same. So I found it very fun and to help other golfers try to get through this confusion and find their way to do it best. And it's not just about their golf swing when I'm teaching golf. I mean, there's all kinds of wedge shots, and there's putting, and there's course management, and there's your ability to concentrate and free yourself from distraction, and all these other things go into it. So I enjoy working with the whole golfer. I find it difficult. What if you're in college today and you want to be a pro golfer and you need to get good coaching, and you get sent to this guy's a sports psychologist, this guy's a trainer, this guy will do your full swing, and this guy will do your short game, and oh, wait a minute, here's a nutritionist to go along with it as well, right?
Right.
Now you've got all these specialty people that may or may not be on the same page with you. They all want to think that it's what they do that makes the difference, right? So the guy, you know, you watch a golfer come down the stretch in a junior golf tournament and he stumbles coming in the last five holes. Well, the swing teacher thinks his swing broke down. The trainer thinks he's not in good enough shape and then the psychologist thinks it was his mental game, and the nutritionist thinks he didn't eat his, you know, bar at the right hole, and
right.
You know what I mean? And so it's very easy for it to be pretty confusing out there. I try to look at the whole golfer from all of those angles, having the experience of working with the experts in all of these areas.
So where do you teach out of down there?
The Plantation Golf Club. It's the only all-men's club in California.
Oh, okay.
And it's a really good course.
Well, I'm going to have to get down there and look you up the next time I'm down in the desert. Well, certainly the game of golf has changed in the last 20 years. Sam, what are some of your thoughts on the changes that you've seen in the game over the last couple decades?
The 90s is when everything changed to me. The 90s is when we started getting metal woods, when I went to Hank Haney, there was sports psychology coming. Everything changed in the 90s, and by the year 2000, my back was a wreck, my swing was short, and I hadn't found the answers to all the confusion that I ran into in the 90s yet. But we used to hit one irons off the tee and just try to rip bullets that would roll down the middle. They couldn't get offline very much, right?
Right, that's right.
Mm-hmm. That shot's gone now. A guy just rips a three wood up in the air and flies it out there.
Yeah. And, you know, the golf courses are a lot more, you know, wide open now than they used to be. I mean, they're not, you know, look at the PGA Tour. They're not playing too many of those tight little tree-lined courses that we used to play.
No, it's different now. It's more open and fly at 300 over the corner, and yeah.
Yeah, if there even is a corner, you know, I mean, it's...
you know, if you're 150 in the rough, you can hit a 9-iron. The rough's not as thick as it used to be. You can just hit a flyer 9-iron and get it on the green somewhere. And what's the risk in trying to bomb it down there?
Yeah, exactly right.
You know what? I played Olympic Club 2 months ago, and they have stretched the course out. It used to be about 6,800 yards back then, even in the 1987 U.S. Open. Of course, it played longer than that, being in San Francisco with the conditions the way they are. But now the course is stretched out to, I think, 7,200 plus. You definitely got to rip it. Yeah. I mean, the second hole, I remember hitting my 1-iron off the tee, just trying to get it out there 240-ish in play, and hit a 9-iron up the hill. The hole was 380. Now, the hole is, I think, 430, and so it's basically, I had to rip a drive and rip a 5-iron up the hill, and it's tough to hit the green in two now.
Yeah, it is. Bradley Hughes and I played there last year, and I hit a nice drive, and I had a 3 or 4-iron into that green, up the hill and the fog and everything, and it's...
But today's player that's in their 20s is going to hit it 25 by me off the tee and hit an 8-iron to that green.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they've had to stretch the courses out with the modern gear and the modern balls and all that. But I think, you know, if you look at Olympic Club, it really is about shaping and curving the ball out there. And, you know, that course is really, I think, designed for the persimmon and bolatas, you know, to where it's all about shaping and curving and the side hill lies, and you got to be working the ball just constantly left and right. I just read an article that Johnny Miller had written about, you know, his experiences growing up at Olympic Club and how all the side hill lies, and that's where he really learned how to play golf, was being able to play that golf course.
Yeah, and then he finished, like, top 10 in the U.S. Open when he was 17, 18 years old, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, who knows where it's going, but I think it's all good, you know. I'm not really so much opposed to, you know, the development of golf as some people think I am, but I just think there should be different genres of competition is all. You know, I just think there should be a persimmon tour, you know, there should be a titanium tour, long drive contests, you know, all that stuff. It all needs to be explored. The thing that bothers me is just seeing all these great classic golf courses, you know, historic courses that are 6,600 yards and 6,800 yards, having those being outdated or having to be remodified very much against their original intentions. And I
think the other thing is that the average golfer gets hurt by this, because the pro swinging 120 miles an hour, getting this big increase from the new ball, and he plays a course that's been stretched from 6,800 to 7,100, 200 yards. The pro doesn't see a big deal, but the amateur that's hit that average distance that isn't really gaining anything from the new equipment, right?
Right.
It's killing him. It's making the course seem too hard.
Right.
Then we end up with five sets of tee blocks, which, gee whiz, to me, I think three's enough.
Yeah. Yeah, the 6,800-yard golf course was a very long golf course back in when we were playing in the 80s, 70s and 80s.
Well, it depends where you play. If you're playing on the West Coast where the ball doesn't fly very far and the ground is softer, then, yeah, those 6,800-yard courses used to play pretty long.
I mean, L.A. Country Club, L.A. North, was about 6,800 from what I remember, and that you know, you're wearing a hole in the long irons out there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with Olympic Club. I think Olympic was 66 or 68, and the same sort of thing. And, you know, a lot of long irons and, you know.
Well, certainly out here in California, you know, we've got a lot of great classic old golf courses, and certainly on the East Coast as well. So, you know, I feel that the players should be tested throughout their game, from driver to long irons, mid and short irons. So, getting to a little bit on equipment here, what are you doing with the golf shaft now and the driver?
I mean, I've gone down to 85 grams in a graphite shaft with my driver, but I won't go down to 55 like they're putting out there now. That's too light.
Well, I'm not impressed with the ball striking on the tour. I'm really not. I mean, I got to grow up playing against guys like you, some other, you know, great players, Corey Pavin, you know. I mean, I saw guys controlling the golf ball when I grew up, and I look at the tour now, I see guys are lucky to get in the fairway 50% of the time. I think
it's quite disappointing.
Well, it's a different. It's not as important to hit the high percentage of fairways now because they can bomb it far enough down there and still get it on the green out of the rough that's not quite as tall as it used to be on tour. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to be as perfect to get a ball to go fairly straight with your swing the way the equipment is. So it's more of a just kill it as far as you can. And it's okay if you hit half the fairways.
I love the picture of Ben Hogan at Olympic Club and, you know, hitting it out of the rough, left rough, and the stuff's like up to his knees. We just don't see that anymore, that kind of rough. I mean, the U.S. amateurs that you won, I mean, I know because I played in those things. You know, you had to hit it straight.
You know, I watched it, Bethpage, and, you know, I still saw guys on the rough stopping it on the greens. You know, maybe the rough was trampled down by the gallery. There's so many people out there. And
well, that's what happens. I can remember in the playing at Oakland Hills and missing the fairway by just a couple yards and being in the thickest rough. And if you missed the fairway by 20 yards, the ground was trampled down, mm-hmm. and you'd be able to knock it on the green. And I thought, that's not fair. The worse you hit it, the better your lie.
Yeah, that's really not fair.
Well, you know what they do now? They make the rough progressively higher the farther offline you get.
Yeah, that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
Those are certainly some interesting points.
Well, we'll certainly come back and talk more about the game and, of course, equipment also. But let's talk a little bit about putting. I mean, you were one amazing putter when you were playing your best golf. What are some of your thoughts on putting?
I mean, were you thinking about your stroke ever, or was it just always just a visual thing, sending the ball down the line? Like, did you feel fairly free over it, or did you feel like you were trying to do something?
You know, looking back at it, I learned a grip from Al Geiberger's caddy that was a double overlap that got my hands together, and I basically got in there comfortable, and I was a little open and where I could see the line, and I would forward press it a little and almost kind of just block it down my line.
You aimed left and blocked. That's what Trevino talked about also.
Okay, so I did that a little bit, similar to the way I would try to drive the ball back then. I found myself to be a streaky putter. Obviously, I had a lot of good putting tournaments and won tournaments, but I also had tournaments where I was hitting the ball good enough to win and putted poorly and didn't also. And so I found it to be very streaky. When I got on the tour, I wanted to be more consistent with my putting. And I thought back then that if I squared myself up and got square and made everything in all these perfect lines, you know, mm-hmm. that I'd putt better. And that didn't make me a better putter. That probably made me a little bit worse.
Maybe because you couldn't see the line quite as well from a square stance?
There was interference. I was trying to do too much stuff right instead of just putting.
Mm-hmm. When you were, you know, putting your best, say, you know, winning the U.S. Amateur and stuff like this, I mean, did you have any thoughts in your head about your stroke, or was it just, you were just visualizing the line and the speed?
I was just visualizing the line and the speed. As a matter of fact, if we go back and watch the tape of that 10-foot left or right downhiller that I made to win the amateur, I didn't care if I took 2 practice strokes, 3, 4. I was just looking and feeling, waiting until I felt ready. And I got up over the ball, and I'm looking up and down the line 7 times.
Yeah, I remember watching you. I counted one time. You looked at the hole 17 times once on a putt. I just couldn't imagine what was going on in your head. I've always wanted to ask you this question. What?
People used to laugh. They would count them on me. I'm winning a tournament there. You looked 12 times on that one, but it was only 6 on this one. What's going on? And I just wait until I was ready to go. Well, once I got on tour, and we, you know, we're trying to get better after the few years on tour, the sports psychology came in. I worked with Bob Rotella quite a bit, who I like a lot. He's a good motivator, storyteller, and he's got some good stuff. But at the same time, it wasn't quite perfect for me because I was trying to consciously do this routine for a while. And one day he said to me, hey, a routine's something that you do just subconsciously. And I whacked myself in the head. It's like, and what am I doing thinking about my routine for? I mean, I'm thinking I've got to just take 2 looks at the hole every time. I got to do the same thing every time, like the field goal kicker or the... And you know what? There is some truth to that. I don't feel the need to look at the hole so many times. Part of it's trying too hard, you know?
Right.
And that would be getting in my own way. So that would be the reason why. But if you start counting how many times you're looking at the hole, are you really paying attention to just putting?
Well, I know you weren't counting. I just wonder if the times that you looked 12 or 17 times at the hole, if you were even aware of it. I mean,
no, I wasn't. I was just looking and feeling and looking and feeling and waiting till I felt ready to roll it down the line in the hole. And it didn't matter if I was square or how many times I looked or any of that stuff.
You looked like a very
instinctive putter.
Just never looked like you were thinking about your stroke, or when you were taking practice strokes, you know, it didn't look like you were watching the putter head or trying to, you know, any, you know, you see guys doing that, you know, like they're trying to do some kind of mechanical putting stroke in their practice.
If there was ever any thought of my putting stroke, it was just the rhythm of it or the timing of it.
Well, you always really looked like a real feel putter. Let's talk a little bit more about this aiming left and pushing the putt out towards the target line.
Did you say you felt like you kind of aimed left and blocked it just a little bit?
Yeah.
So what that would do is it would kind of get your hands to just lead a little bit to open.
Yes.
It would tend to open
the
face.
With the back of your left hand.
Mm-hmm.
Closer to the way Dave Stockton teaches putting nowadays. He's the new hot teacher. He and Dave Jr. out on the tour. They've been helping a lot of guys putt better.
Mm-hmm. And what's he been teaching, basically, in your...
He likes you to putt with the back of the left hand, get it arched up there.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't like practice strokes. He likes you to putt over a spot right in front of your ball. A lot of good stuff. And he's as confident as you can get. The biggest thing, whether you stroke it just like him or not, is, boy, to have half the confidence he does in himself. You know?
We talked a little bit about, you know, looking at the hole and putting with your eyes closed and that sort of thing.
Mm. I find that looking at the hole gets you away from paying too much attention to what's going on down by the ball, but it also takes you up out into a different posture when you're swinging the stroke. I think that's why you don't see people doing that. They practice that, but they don't keep doing it. You know, we've never seen a guy on TV on the tour putting while he's looking at the hole. Not for 2 weeks in a row, anyway.
But putting with the eyes closed, that's kind of an interesting one. Johnny Miller apparently says he did that when he won the Crosby.
That's the best thing you can do. Closing your eyes does two things. For one, if you're putting, if you've already read the putt, you've already gotten over the putt, and you're lined up, looking down the line, taking a picture of the line and the speed and the ball going in, just like Tiger's dad taught him, putt to the picture. Well, when you come back and make the stroke, you're not actually looking at the hole anymore, but you have it in your mind's eye from taking the picture. So if you were to take the picture, come back and close your eyes, the picture's still in your mind's eye, so you're still putting to that picture. But what happens is you become more aware from the inside out of what you're doing and what's happening. And you eliminate interference from being able to see stuff, you know? So I think it makes you more aware of what you're really doing. Plus, when I teach, I try to get guys to read the putt, take the picture, get up over it, take a look, take the picture, come back. Now close your eyes, putt the ball, don't even look, okay? And wait till the ball's about done rolling and tell me, is that right or left, long or short? And they've got to tell you where they think it went without looking. And we did this a couple weeks ago. A friend of mine who's a teaching pro, his speed was off, and we started doing this little drill. So at first, he would putt one, and he would tell me with his eyes closed, oh, I think that went 2 feet by, and it would be 2 feet short.
Wow.
And this happened for 10 minutes. He was consistently 4 feet short of where he thought. Well, after we had done this for closer to a half an hour, his guess was down to within a foot of where he was actually going. And he actually made 2 25-footers in a row with his eyes closed at the end, and we just high-fived each other and started laughing and going, how good is this, you know?
Have you tried doing this on the golf course, gone out and played putter with your eyes closed?
Not as much as I should. I also find when I'm out in the desert this past season, I was hitting 6 irons with my eyes closed on the range. And a couple of the members came over and commented how much smoother my swing looked. when I was hitting it with my eyes closed.
You know, George Knudsen says that he played an entire round at Glen Abbey with his eyes closed and shot 68.
Oh, that's awesome. I got to go do it now. At least 9 holes. I got to line up, take the picture, and go with my eyes closed and see what happens for 9 holes. I'm going to be doing that here in the next couple weeks.
Yeah, I think that was really interesting. You know, Knudsen was a real thinker about the swing and stuff, too. I loved his golf swing, and I loved a lot of his thoughts. I don't know if you've ever read his book.
I've got his book in my library. It's a really good one.
Yeah.
He did a lot of things like Hogan did.
Yeah, it's got some really great stuff in there. So, you know, reading greens a little bit. Any thoughts on that? Like what you look for as you approach the green, as you're walking up to the green? And
you know, they've got some green reading systems out there now. One of them actually is really good, the aim point, where you try to find the spot that's right underneath the hole. Johnny Miller always refers to it as the fall line, and you make it like a clock. And if you can find what's straight up the fall line from 6 o'clock to 12 o'clock, then as you move around the clock, you adjust the amount of break. And once you get up higher than 3 o'clock, it's starting to go downhill instead of uphill now. And I think that's a good way to look at the green when you're walking up to it. Where's the underneath part? And you start to survey the green before you even mark your ball. And I think that's huge. And then if you can go on the side of your putt, underneath the hole, you get a really good view that helps you tie the line and the speed together. Because, I mean, if I'm caddying and you say, what do you think here, and you got a 15-footer that's breaking about a foot right to left, okay? I mean, there's 3 different lines you can make that putt on, depending what speed you use.
Sure, at least, yeah.
Right? I've actually been doing that with a friend of mine who's going to senior qualifying school here. Instead of doing a drill where you're hitting all the same putt all the time, I try to make this breaking putt on 3 different lines, and then you start having to read each one individually and tie the speed to the line. I think the speed's always more important, don't you?
Yeah. What do you think about when you look at a putt and you get one read from one side and you go on the hole side and you look back and it looks totally different? Which do you go with?
That's when I'll go down to the side underneath and try to make my decision there. And if that doesn't work, I'll go with the first one, the first thing I saw. If there's any, and that's where you might call your caddy and what do you see here, you know?
How important was it to have a good caddy when you were on tour?
I would say it helps a little bit. But a little bit can sometimes make a big difference. I always felt like the player is the one responsible for the decision, so it can't ever be the caddy's fault what I do.
Do you think it helps to have a caddy that's a pretty good player?
Yeah, if he's not a pretty good player, it's hard for him to relate to what you're doing. I wouldn't say he has to be a good player. I mean, because a guy can still get to know you real well, even if he's not a good player.
I know our buddy Stu caddied for you. You know, Stu played on the team with me at Fresno State. You know, good player. He's a good golfer.
Yeah, Stu was a good caddy for me. One of my best caddies. Yeah.
Yeah, I would.
He knew me since I was a kid playing, and you know, part of it is just having a good friend on the bag, just to tell jokes with, and because there's a lot of time in between shots.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of time in between shots.
You really only have to concentrate for a small amount of time in intervals. It doesn't matter that much what happens in between.
I think you only spend something like 20 minutes actually hitting shots on the course, something like that.
Yeah. If you started measuring it when you approached your ball and started planning your shot, then it would be closer to a minute for your shot or 45 seconds or something. It wouldn't be just the 10 seconds over the ball. But if you break it down to, even if you were slow and you took a whole minute to plan your shot, and then, heck, I watch Tiger take longer than that to hit putts because he's reading it for a minute, you know? But 1 minute times, I mean, that's an hour, a little over an hour. Even if you're shooting 80, that's only an hour and 20 minutes, and that's, what, a fourth of the time you're out there?
Boy, there's so many putting theories, you know, out there. I mean, you know, I know Lauren Roberts with the really heavy putter. He's got a 20-ounce putter or something like that.
Yeah, well, he just hangs those arms straight down. He's got really short arms, too, so he can do that better. Just swings it from the muscles in his back. Your shoulders really only are a way to measure the movement of your upper body. I mean, they don't control the bottom of your arm like it's made out to think.
How much wrist did you have in your stroke when you were back in the 80s? Did you have a little play in the wrists when you were putting?
No.
None at all?
Forward press it, lock it in, and then just swing.
It was just all with the shoulders?
Arms and shoulders.
Arms and shoulders. So a little bit of independent movement in the sockets?
Yeah.
In the arm sockets? And a little bit of shoulders, but just no hands?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, because your shoulders are just sockets that are the top of your arms hanging out of there, and your arms swing from there.
Did you ever mess with the Dave Peltz putting track thing that Verplank was killing us with back then?
Yeah. I find it the most effective putting track, I think, is the one that Momentus does now that is take it back a little more inside and then straight through more.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows you that the release of the putter is actually the toe releasing up the plane more than it is the whole putter going back inside on the way through. Because our first putting arcs have been inside to inside, right?
Right, right.
Now we have it more inside to down the line, and the release is a little more of an upward toe release. That's what Tiger's stroke does.
Mm-hmm.
That's what most of the strokes actually do. And I think that's the best one. It's a yellow track that you can get from Momentus.
So it's a little bit curved then, sort of, right? It's not like the Peltz track that had the little legs and you'd kind of bank it up.
Right.
Verplank sure putted good with that thing, didn't he?
Jeez.
Made me a believer. I mean, you know, I started working on that thing after I played with him in the Sunny Hannah, and he was showing me that on the putting green, and I just, you know,
Hey, we were wrapping that gauze tape on our grips too.
Yeah. Anything to putt like he putted.
That's right.
Jeez.
Golfers can be crazy.
I mean, that was a pretty easy sales pitch to me when I watched that 66 hitting 8 greens. I just thought, boy, if I could putt like that, I'd be shooting in the 50s. You know, seriously. I mean, I'm not kidding.
Yeah, it's just...
I mean, you know, he didn't really hit the ball that great. I mean, it wasn't all that... You know, I think he maybe figured some stuff out later, but...
Yeah.
He hits it better now, but back then, I mean, it wasn't really all that impressive tee to green. He didn't hit it like you hit it, I know that.
No, but he could beat us when it was inside of 50 yards.
Yeah, I mean, how many times did you watch a guy, you know, play a whole round and not miss inside 15 feet? I mean, you probably
right.
did.
I've watched him hit it good, too, though, and putt like that. You can't shoot those scores he shot without doing both.
Between the two of you and, you know, Billy Andre was playing pretty good then, too, at that time. But did you ever mess with a long putter?
Never liked it. I'm left-handed. I didn't like just putting all right arm.
When you were talking about the putting track thing, were you ever using a putting track when you were putting really well in the 80s?
No.
So it was just kind of, the stroke was a little more sort of free-form back then? And then when you moved to a track later, that was because why? You felt like your stroke was kind of not what it was, or you wanted to just try and refine it more?
A mistake made was, later on trying to make everything all squared up and all parallel. Thinking that that would make putting better was not true.
Well, you used the ping, right? Was it ping answer or ping pal?
Yeah, ping answer.
Ping answer, yeah. Use that through... pretty much most of the 80s, right?
Yeah.
Are you still using that?
No.
Was it pretty much just a kind of off the shelf sort of ping answer, or did you do any modifications to it?
I put a little lead tape on the bottom of it just to give it a little more weight. I remember that. I had a decent amount of loft on my ping putter so I could forward press it forward and a little bit of lead tape on it. That was about it.
And I know you had a little bit of the gauze, like we both kind of did the gauze.
Yeah, I messed with that for a little bit, too, with it, because Verplank, yeah, making everything like other people. Billy Andre had it on there, too, I think.
Yeah. I've got a picture of us playing at Sandpiper, I think Watney gave me years ago, where we both had gauze on our putters or something.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's hard to argue with
argue with that with the way he was putting. So, all right. Well, I think that's
perfect.
Well, thanks, Sam. We'll be getting back here to our fourth and final installment of the Advanced Ball Striking interview with Sam Randolph.